Margaret Throsby on ABC Classic FM. Many music lovers regard the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra as the best in the world, and the string section to be unequalled for the purity and transparency of its sound. But have you ever stopped to wonder why this is so? What is it that makes one set of instrumentalists sound better than another, or one individual for that matter? Why was Casals's cello sound, or Kreisler's violin, Heinz Holliger's oboe, Miles Davis's trumpet, so distinctive and in most cases more beautiful than others? Was it the way these giants played, the technique they perfected, or was it the quality of the actual sound they produced, or a combination of these things? These are the sorts of questions that intrigue our guest today, Professor Joe Wolf, who, as a physicist and a musician, specialises in the study of sound. He runs the Music Acoustics Group with Dr. John Smith at the University of New South Wales, and they get involved in all sorts of tricky studies, measuring what happens inside instruments as they're played, how sounds can vary from the same instrument played by different people, what goes on in the mouth of wind players, that sort of thing. One of their most interesting projects involves studying the didgeridoo. Joe Wolf joins us today and has brought along with him his selection of five pieces of music, including a couple of pieces he himself composed. First, though, music by Nigel Westlake. That's the sound of a bass clarinet played by Nigel Westlake, and he was playing his composition called Onomatopoeia, scored for bass clarinet and digital delay, chosen by our guest, Professor Joe Wolf. Good morning.
Good morning, Margaret.
Welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
That's a good start for a conversation about sound and musical sound. Why? Tell us about the choice of that.
Well, there's a few things. I've never heard a piece of Nigel's that I didn't like. He's a great composer. This particular piece, he performs live, multi-layering with the digital delay, and it's partly improvised, and I guess the old jazz man in me really likes that. And there's something sort of hypnotic about it as well. One gets taken in by it. And then there's another thing that links ABC FM and me a decade or so. I made a series about the science of music for ABC FM, and we used that as the theme, the intro and outro. So,
yeah. It's long ago, but I remember it. I remember it. Joe, tell me this. The physics of sound is complex, and I think most people listening, and I'll include myself here, know that sound travels in waves and is interpreted by our brains via our ears and auditory nerves. What do you study in your music lab?
We're interested in the acoustics of musical instruments, the human voice, and to some extent, the ear. We want to know how they work, and in the case of musicians, how they interact.
You want to know how a violin works? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, the violin is perhaps the most studied, so there's not that much left. Mm. We've published a few papers on the violin, the things that are left over. We're mainly concentrated on wind instruments and the voice more than that, because they're not so well understood.
Let's take the flute then, because I think that's where you started, didn't you, with flutes. Now, you hand a flute to Jean-Pierre Rampal, and he would have produced the most exquisite sound. The same flute to someone blowing through the thing will produce a sound, a note maybe, but will sound nothing like it. Is that just because that person doesn't know the technique of playing a flute, or is there something else going on?
There's lots of things going on. There's the subtle technique of controlling your hands, the even more subtle technique of controlling your mouth. And for some of the wind instruments, there's a close coupling between the waves in the instrument and the waves inside you. Actually, in the flute, that's less important than most winds, but it's something that we're very interested in.
Just explain that? What do you mean?
Well, particularly for the instruments with the reed or the brass instruments, you have something, the reed or the lips, vibrating and sending sound waves into the instrument. They also send sound waves into your body, into your upper vocal tract, and you get resonances in both cases. The instrument will resonate at certain frequencies. Your vocal tract will resonate at certain frequencies.
So does it feel when you're playing a trumpet that you're singing at the same time?
You can, but that's a sort of modern performance technique to sing into a trumpet. But we find that the experienced players tend to keep their vocal folds in the position for whispering. Now, when you whisper, you can still hear what I'm saying. And that's because there are resonances in the vocal tract that carry the information of speech. Those resonances in the vocal tract used for whispering also can affect the output sound in some instruments.
You're going too fast. The vocal tract is what?
The vocal tract, the part of your throat from, say, just behind your lips down to your Adam's apple.
That's the vocal tract.
Yeah, the upper vocal tract.
So that contains what we call the vocal cords, does it?
Yes, the vocal folds is the technical name, and it's less misleading than vocal cords. They're folds of flesh that can completely close the tract or open and vibrate. They're not like little wires, not cords hanging across it. And you get quite strong reflections there. Any sound that goes past there down into your lungs tends to get absorbed. So while the lungs are important for providing the breath, they're not really acoustically important.
I'm still just intrigued by that whispering example that you gave, because if we whisper, there's no voice coming through the voice box, but there's articulated words. It's on breath and it's made with your mouth. Is that what we're saying?
That's right. There's some turbulent air going between the vocal folds, just like shh, it's going between my teeth, and now ah, going between my vocal folds. That turbulent air you can imagine as having lots of frequencies present in it, and some of them get selected by the resonances in your upper vocal tract. And ah, ee, oh have got different sets of resonances.
Interesting. Well, look, back to playing the instrument then, not the flute. We'll talk about a brass or, say, the oboe.
Mm-hmm.
There are vibrations in the lips that vibrate back into the vocal tract?
In the case of the oboe, it's the reed, and it's opening and closing many times per second at the frequency of the note, and that sends a signal into the oboe, but it also sends a more or less equal signal back into the player's vocal tract.
And what's the effect of that?
Well, on the oboe, we don't know. We haven't studied that yet.
What have you studied then?
Well, we started with the didgeridoo, because the didgeridoo is the instrument where the vocal tract is most spectacularly involved. We're interested in this general problem, and we thought, well, the didgeridoo is where it is enormous. In fact, there's not much else of importance going on in the didgeridoo. There is only one pitch, or one or two, being used in the main pipe of the instrument, and yet the player can make these spectacular tone colour changes by moving his tongue while playing.
Can he change the note? We say he. Do any women play didgeridoos?
In some traditional societies, it's only initiated men who play, so I tend to say he.
Okay. So the didgeridoo, we'll stay with the didgeridoo for a second, is a long pipe, isn't it? It's a sapling that's got its insides are gone, so it's a hollow pipe. And it's placed at the... There's some kind of wax at the end to make it comfortable to play, I think, isn't
there?
That's right. And the mouth is, what, pushed into the opening? Or it doesn't... you don't put your mouth around the opening, do you?
No, you put your lips almost touching and you cover it with the input of the instrument. So the embouchure is much like for a tuba, and you buzz your lips.
So you actually do that yourself into your lips, and what does that do? That sets up sound waves in the instrument itself, does it?
Yeah, you don't have to consciously buzz them. If you blow, the resonance in the pipe will cause your lips to vibrate.
Must be a funny feeling.
It is. Your lips feel a little bit strange when you've played for a little while, unless you're an experienced brass player.
And you mean the colour and tone of a didgeridoo is defined by changes in the mouth as you play, changes in what you're doing with your lips, is it?
Not so much the lips, but more the tongue. The most spectacular thing you hear with the didgeridoo is due to circular breathing. When the player is breathing in, he seals his mouth off with the soft palate and inhales through the nose while using air stored in the cheeks to keep the sound going.
Oh, I don't believe it.
I wish I'd brought didgeridoo in with me.
They really do that. So they have air in the mouth, but you can only store a very small amount in your mouth.
Sure, you puff your cheeks out.
Is that why they're going...
Exactly.
So they're breathing through the nose.
Breathing in through the nose, expelling the air from the mouth.
Under what pressure? Because if they're breathing through the nose, they're using their breathing muscles to breathe in. They can't. How do they expel the air through their mouth?
Just squeezing your cheeks.
Like that?
Yeah, just exactly like that. And it's not terribly hard to do. It doesn't require a huge pressure because the pipe is so big.
But it must require constant. You must be doing it all the time.
That's right. It's probably good for the breathing.
Must give you Dizzy Gillespie cheeks too, does it? Remember those pictures of Dizzy Gillespie with those enormous cheeks that he had?
The trumpet requires a lot more pressure than the didgeridoo, so maybe the famous players like William Barton are safe from that fate for a little while. But the interesting thing about that is that when you seal off your vocal tract from your mouth with the palate, you've got one set of resonances, the ones that belong to your mouth alone. And then when you close the nose off so that you can breathe out from your lungs, you're using a completely different set. So that regular cycle of breathing in and breathing out gives different tone colours to the instrument. And so there's a regular change. That's the basic rhythm in didgeridoo playing. And then over that, they superimpose all sorts of other changes by moving the tongue or, in some cases, vocalising, singing into it as well.
Does each didgeridoo have one note?
Perhaps two or even three, but the higher notes, usually about a musical 11th higher, are only used rarely for
sort of punctuation. So you couldn't play Eine kleine Nachtmusik on a didgeridoo?
Not easily, no.
No, well, you couldn't play a melody on a didgeridoo.
Not an ordinary melody. I guess a really skilled player would say, well, by bringing out certain of these high resonances, I can play a tune in those high resonances while the didgeridoo is maintaining a drone.
Oh, yes. It is one-off, isn't it? The didgeridoo is unique in the world in terms... Is it? Is there anything remotely like it anywhere else?
There are some instruments that are vaguely similar. There's an Irish horn. There's a long Swiss horn as well that have some...
Like the Alpine horn or something?
A bit like that, yeah.
Yeah, because they're the long things that I think they rest on the ground, perhaps, like a didgeridoo.
Yeah.
Very interesting. So getting back to a flute then, tell me why it's important to know what you're studying.
Well, my colleague, Prof. John Smith, and I started looking at flutes about a decade ago because they were less studied than the other winds. The flute is open to the air where you blow. You don't seal across the input of a flute. You leave it open to the air. And that means that the sound signals at the input are much smaller. So there were technical problems in measuring the acoustic response of the flute the way people had previously done for other wind instruments. So we thought we had some good ideas for overcoming those technical difficulties. So we started with the flute.
How do you get inside a flute to study it while it's being played?
Oh, that's
the answer is with great difficulty.
That is. But when we started, we were interested in the flute alone. Mm. And we studied the flute without the player because that's important to us to understand how it works. But it's also important to people like makers. They're not so much interested in comparing flutist combinations because the flutist is so important. They would really like to know, is this instrument better than that one? Is this one more in tune than that one? And so they were the sort of questions we were hoping to answer. So we would clamp our apparatus over the embouchure hole of a flute, pump several thousand frequencies into it at once and measure how the flute responded. And then after a while, we thought we understood the flute rather well, and we've got a couple of useful practical applications out of that. And then we thought, okay, let's look at other instruments, and more importantly, let's look at how the instrument and the player interact. And that's where we're at now.
Okay, well, can you hold that thought and we'll listen to some more music? But we've got William Barton now with music of Peter Sculthorpe called Earth Cry. Tell us what to listen for in this, because he's playing with an orchestra, the Queensland Orchestra. Mm-hmm. So what are we going to listen for in this?
Well, I chose this partly because Sculthorpe is such a uniquely Australian sound. In jazz and in rock, I don't think you can really say that there's a clear Australian sound, but Sculthorpe's voice for most of my lifetime has been what I regard as Australian music. So that's one of the reasons. William Barton has arrived recently. He's a great friend of Peter's. And so Peter's rewritten some of the works, including this one. You'll hear a didgeridoo solo coming through the orchestral texture. And there's what's virtually a cadenza. And then you realise that actually this is all on a drone note, a single note underlying it all. Most dramatic. Thank you.
Peter Sculthorpe's work Earth Cry. The soloist was the didgeridoo player William Barton with the Queensland Orchestra, conducted by Michael Christie and chosen by our guest, Professor Joe Wolfe. We're talking about the physics of sound. What's the point of it all, though, Joe? I mean, is there a practical application to this sort of research that you're doing?
Gradually, yes, we developed the practical applications. We were talking about the flute a little while ago. Once we thought we had a theoretical model of the flute that was really precise, and I specified that for musicians, precision is important. I mean, you might say if you understand to 1% accuracy, that's good enough to put in a textbook. Yes, but 1% out of tune is a sixth of a semitone. It's unacceptable for a musician. So we were aiming for precision. When we thought we'd got close enough, we looked for applications, and one of them was developed by a wonderful student of ours, Andrew Botros. And we took all of the possible configurations of the flute. It's got lots of keys, and you can push them down in different combinations. There's nearly 40,000 different fingerings possible on a flute. And then he set his computer to work out the frequency response for every one of those. Then we ran a expert system over the database looking for the playability features, and we trained that expert system on a lovely flutist called Jane Kavanagh, who's now a part-time research assistant in the lab. And so then we've got an expert system that knows the acoustical features of everything in this database, and then Andrew made a user-friendly front end that sits on the web. So flutists who are faced with really awkward passages can go to this thing called the virtual flute and ask it, is there an easier way of doing this? Is there another fingering for this note that is faster to go from this note to that one? Some composer's written you an impossibly awkward bit of fingering. Let's look for something easier. Or you might find that this fingering's unstable when you do this transition. Is there a more stable one? And the virtual flute can help there. And then finally,
wow.
Finally, if you're a flutist confronted with, you know, late 20th, early 21st century material, you'll find that they ask for different timbral effects and for microtone intonations, or even for you to play chords or multiphonics, as they're called, two or three notes at once. And now you can go to the virtual flute and say, is it possible to play this note and that note and that note at the same time? Or is it possible? Can you find me a good fingering that lies halfway between F sharp and G? We've possibly even extended the range of the instrument by looking for the high.
We're not moving towards a homogenised sort of sound, are we?
No, though you could, if you like, look for, you know, the brightest timbre for each note and do that. In some circumstances you might. But a lot of these modern composers actually want to contrast it. They want to do a little bit like the didgeridoo, change the timbre at the same pitch.
Mm.
So that was one of the applications.
I don't know why I'm thinking of it, but I'm thinking of Django Reinhardt, who you probably know had lost some fingers on his guitar fingering hand.
His left
hand,
yeah.
Yes, and on his, was it on his, yeah. And he devised this extraordinary system for himself with his remaining fingers and became the best guitarist. It'd be interesting to study somebody with a disability, wouldn't it?
Yes, some makers have made special instruments for disabilities and, yeah.
And work out the best way. I mean, I can see tremendous application for that. Mm. Can we talk about the voice, the human voice?
Mm-hmm.
How do you what have you been studying there? What have you been trying to work out about the human voice?
Well, one thing that we wanted to do was analyse these resonances that we were talking about before and measure them precisely. Now, for years, people have been studying them using the voice itself as the measuring technique. Now, that's very good because it doesn't perturb the subject and it's natural.
When you're saying measuring, are you talking about how fast it vibrates or at what? Is it a technical, it's not a subjective, qualitative decision you're making, is it?
Well, it's both of those. You and I can subjectively determine that R and E are different sounds, so we are detecting the effects of certain resonances in the vocal tract. Technically, you can use instruments that analyse the spectrum, analyse how the sound's made up from different frequencies and analyse the voice that way.
So you'd be able to very accurately measure accent, wouldn't you?
Well, you can record accents, but when you come to understanding the mechanism, what's giving rise to it, the voice itself is not optimal because the sounds that come out of your vocal cords are harmonic. You get a particular frequency that determines the pitch, and you get twice that frequency, three times that frequency, and four times and so forth. But the trouble with that from a scientific point of view is it's not many frequencies, particularly for women's voices or high-pitched children's voices, high singing voices. There are not many frequencies available in the range of interest. Excuse me. So our technique was to say, well, let's put in more. And so we get people to talk or to sing while just at their lips we inject sound. We have a small tube that brings a thousand or so different frequencies that we've carefully synthesized, sends it down into their vocal the vocal tract.
Can they hear it?
Yeah, they can hear it.
It's audible.
It sounds a little bit like the wind blowing. It's a shh. Right. It's got lots of frequencies in it. But
it goes into the mouth.
It goes into the mouth. We have a microphone just outside the mouth, and that microphone records not just the voice of the speaker and the singer, but also how their vocal tract affects our synthetic tone. You can think of it as sort of multi-frequency sonar. The reflected sound tells us what's going on inside the mouth with much greater precision than you can get from the voice itself.
How fascinating. And I presume there's no uniformity whatsoever between from one voice to the next.
No, there has to be some similarities because otherwise you wouldn't be understood.
Yes.
If you don't have roughly the right resonances, people, well, first they think it's a strange accent. They may be able to map it after a little bit of listening, as you do. We learn the right accent when we're
That
kids.
Makes me think of people with profound hearing loss who have a particular way of speaking which is very easy to recognise. There's a slight nasality to it often, isn't there? Do we understand what that's about, where that comes from?
Yes, that one's fairly simple, actually, because if you're deaf and you're learning by lip reading, one thing that you can't see is the soft palate at the back of the mouth. And so inadequate control of the soft palate is a sort of feature of the deaf accent.
So how do you learn adequate control of it? You do it by trial and error as you're learning to speak, presumably.
Well, you and I do, yes. We can hear that sound.
I'm not talking about the deaf person. I'm talking about the child getting to speech.
Yes.
Does it by imitation, I presume.
That's right. And it's very easy because if you tell someone what you want and they don't understand you, there's a very strong feedback mechanism to teach you appropriate pronunciation.
Did you work with cochlear implants early on?
Yes, we had a project with cochlear, about a decade ago. And there it was a different story. The cochlear implant has evolved in the engineering sense of the world, in the engineering sense of the word, to understand speech. It's the thing that everyone wants with a cochlear implant. They want their children to hear them or be able to hold a telephone conversation. And to a large extent, they can. When the surgery is successful, the patient is mentally flexible, and there's not too much damage to the nerves of the ear, the cochlear implants work spectacularly well for speech. You can have an intelligible conversation over the phone with a completely deaf person who has such an implant. But it doesn't work nearly so well for music, and so we were asked by Cochlear if we could look into that. And so we developed a coding strategy that appears to have improved that.
So that when they go to a concert or listen to a CD, they can hear more accurately what a hearing person might hear.
Yes, I'm afraid that we're a long way short of that. There are technical reasons why melody and harmony are very difficult to translate into the electrical signals that the implant injects into.
Why? You'd wonder why.
Well, it's partly because of the frequency precision. There's only 24 channels going in there.
Into a cochlear implant.
That's right.
Yeah.
And you and I have got something like 20,000 channels, 20,000 nerve fibres.
Maybe cochlear implants are in their infancy, and in 100 years' time when you and I have this conversation again, we'll be saying, gosh, you know, in 2007 they were like Neanderthals compared with now. I mean, it's the sort of technology you can imagine developing and developing and developing, can't you?
Yes. There are limits. There's a limit to how small you can make the electrodes, because the smaller you make them, and still put the same current through, the more damage you're likely to do to the tissue nearby. So there are limitations.
Is that finite? I mean, is that determined by physics, or is that just because technology hasn't developed that far yet?
Well, there are ways of getting around it, but you get to a point of limiting returns. There are ways of making a small electrode with a large surface using structured platinum on it. But This gets into
quantum mechanics, doesn't it? Which is one of your, isn't it?
Well, quantum mechanics is at the basis of everything. So yes, whenever you're talking about a material and you get down to the small scale, you're getting into quantum mechanics.
I love it. I wish I understood it. We might talk a bit about it in a while, but can we, I want to play some of your music now. This is a quartet, in fact, for flute, sax, bassoon and cello. Tell me about this.
Well, I really love chamber music. I don't love it as a spectator sport. I really like being in it. You know, a handful of friends making eye contact over the music, interpreting it in a sort of democratic way. Everybody has an influence on the tempo, what we're going to do with this phrase.
It's not what we hear about some trios, but never mind.
Maybe. But quite different from orchestral music with a conductor. And, you know, one of my great delights is to invite a few people around, play some music and then have dinner. It's what I do instead of television, I suppose.
What a gorgeous idea.
Anyway, there's not enough chamber music with saxophone in it. And saxophone's the instrument on which I feel the most comfortable. So I wrote this for a few friends and myself.
For dinner. That's The Waltz from the Quartet for Flute, Saxophone, Bassoon and Cello by our guest today, Joe Wolfe. That's lovely.
Oh, thanks very much.
You know
much.
What it made me think of? It made me think of European movie music somehow. There's something sort of sad about it. It's lovely. Who was playing? You were playing saxophone.
That's right. Anna Naylor was the flutist. Yep. Petrina Slater was the bassoonist and Guy Curd playing cello in that particular performance.
That's very nice. Thank you. Congratulations. And I'm looking forward to hearing the next piece because we've got another of yours coming up. But I want to find out about the curiosity that you have of this in this interesting field. I mean, were you always a curious person, a curious child?
Yes, I guess that's how I ended up in science. You know, I would ask why of my dad, my mum and my teachers.
Could they answer?
Very often, yes. My dad was a schoolie. He's a teacher. And so he had taught lots of things and he was able to point me in the right directions. And he bought an Encyclopedia Britannica so that I could chase things further. I guess, though, the best thing, though, the thing that really got me hooked was when he'd say, one of the teachers would say, "I don't think anyone knows that." And it was like a drug. You know, there are things that people don't know. There are things even my teachers don't know. I want a part of that.
And was it all in the sort of area of physics?
Well, it could be in anything. You know, you might ask, why is grass green? And you'd say, well, there's a biochemical answer to that. And that is,
I'd say, go and ask your father.
Excellent plan.
Yeah, but there's a, yes, go on, sorry.
So there's a biochemical, you know, chlorophyll absorbs this frequency and that frequency. And then you say, but why? And then you look at the atom and there's sort of a chemistry answer there. And then you say, well, why does that particular arrangement of electrons absorb? And of course, that's quantum mechanics and you're in physics. And so in a sense, a very large number of why questions lead you to physics.
What was the best birthday present you ever got as a child?
Ooh, can I take that one on notice?
Take it on notice and think about it for a minute. Because I'm just thinking, if you have a child like that, as a parent, and you can understand.
Oh,
go on.
It's the Meccano set. It just has to be. Yeah, the Meccano set. I got they got me the one with the gearbox material. There were crown wheels and pinions and angled pinions, and you could make differentials and gearbox. Oh, it was just wonderful.
Probably kept you going for years and years and years. What an inspired choice of present, eh?
Indeed.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up all over Queensland. Dad was a teacher and got transferred from place to place.
Back blocks as well as the city?
Oh, mainly the larger towns. Dad started off in tiny towns. I guess his first school was a one-teacher school in Nindy Gully in central Queensland.
You go there? I mean, did he ever teach you?
No, he always managed to keep ahead of me, which was rather gratifying.
When it came to choice of career or choice of degree, did you do science as your first degree and physics as a specialty?
Yeah, that was clear. I hesitated between physics and music because, you know, I started playing in bands when I was a teenager. But at two occasions, after high school and after my first degree, different family friends gave me the same good advice. They says it would be better to be a physicist for money and a musician for fun than the other way round. And I think they were right.
Probably, although I don't know whether physicists get paid their dues either, do they? Well, so, you studied physics. Did you specialise in any... Did you find yourself wanting to specialise in any particular area early on?
It didn't occur to me that it was possible to do music acoustics as a career, and it is a bit of a chancy business. But I was very excited by biophysics. I was interested in what holds molecules together in the particular complicated ways that are necessary to make a cell. So I ended up doing my PhD at ANU on cellular thermodynamics, what keeps cellular molecules together and, in the bad cases, when do they fall apart?
Well, and do you understand it all? I find all of that intriguing but so incomprehensible. And I wonder about the teaching of physics. Do you think physics today is well taught in school?
I'd have to say that in the eastern states of Australia, I'm disappointed with the way physics is taught. There's a new syllabus that has gone a bit postmodern. It's got lots of history and social studies in it rather than the actual physics. I mean, there are good democratic reasons for this. You know, there are lots of people who don't like physics and who don't like teaching it, and they would probably be much more comfortable learning and teaching the history of physics than learning physics itself. But my view's a bit elitist. I think that, you know, our scientists and our engineers should be elite. You know, you really do want the person who designed this thing upon which your life depends to be an elite
person. The
best,
yes. Yeah.
So I would like to see a little bit more elitism and the real physics go back in.
Do you think some people are naturally good at physics? I mean, there's a sort of a natural niche for people in physics, do you think?
Oh, yeah, there are some people who have the curiosity and also have a sort of quantitative analytical ability. And I guess that's one of my complaints about the new syllabus, in that many of the people who have that ability may never discover it because it's not required.
When you say an analytical ability, you mean being able to look at a picture and being able to deconstruct it, if that's the right word, or ask the right questions about it, or what?
That's right. To set up a model, to say, well, what are the key principles that underlie this? What approximations can we make? Can we then formulate it according to physical principles? Can we translate that into mathematics? Can we solve the mathematics? And when we've got the answer, take that back into the physical world.
Is the foundation of all of this a complete understanding of the laws of physics then, I presume?
Oh, it's more than that. I would say that the laws are not too tricky. Doing the maths is not too tricky. It's the seeing in the real world example what are the underlying principles. That's the hard bit, making the model, knowing
the
what
connection.
To forget, knowing what to keep, knowing what's going to be important in different cases.
Give us an example, Joe.
Teaching my first-year physics class earlier this year, Dick Cheney was visiting, and he has a reputation for shooting his hunting partners. And so I told the student, suppose he's going on a hunting trip with his opposite number, Peter Costello, how would we make a bulletproof vest? Now, what are the important things here? It's a question upon which someone's life might depend. Let's analyse it. Now, it's an analysis that requires three or four different steps. You have to break down the different aspects of the problem. The fact that the bulletproof vest will spread the shock over a large area of the chest, whereas the bullet wouldn't. There's the collision between the bullet and the vest, which dissipates a lot of the mechanical energy. And then there's the way that the chest responds by being hit by a massive object travelling at a considerable speed. And so all of those have to be separated out, analysed individually, and then you have to synthesise the whole thing into an important answer, you know, which is how big must this be, how massive must it be, so that I don't get killed when the bullet hits me.
Do you think technology has interfered with this at all, in the sense of, I don't want this to sound like a wacky question, but it occurs to me that, because as you were describing that, I can see what you're saying, but then is the impulse to reach for software to interpret results and let it all be done by the machine, rather than to carry it right through to its conclusion that had to be done by physicists prior to the technological age?
Well, there's two things in that. One is that the software essentially only does the easy bits, the grabbing the laws and solving the equations, and that really isn't hard. Mm. The hard thing is knowing which equations to use and when to use them, how to fit them to this particular problem. That's difficult.
Is that inspiration or trial and error?
There are techniques to learn that. And it's problem solving is perhaps the most important thing that we can teach people.
I'm glad I did broadcasting. Tell us about this, the Stairway Suite, another of your pieces.
Right, the Stairway Suite is my best known or orchestral work. It's the orchestral work for which I'm most infamous, I like to say. You know the Denton story of Money or the Gun, and each week someone played Stairway to Heaven in a different style. And this was about the time when the University of New South Wales Orchestra was started. And they said to me, we'd like, something spectacular to make our presence known. They said, let's have an orchestral version of Stairway to Heaven. My response was, whose orchestra? What sort of orchestral version? And we decided that since there were 7 weeks before the first rehearsal, it would be a suite of 7 versions of Stairway, each in the style of a different composer. I think we've got the Beethoven version queued up.
Okay. the Beethoven section of Joe Wolff's Stairway Suite. And it was the University of New South Wales Orchestra conducted by Colin Piper. Who were the singers, Joe?
That was the University of New South Wales Orchestra Chorus.
It was Orchestra Chorus. Our
friends from the choir who
they
were dragged in on that.
Damn good.
Oh, yeah.
And that's these two pieces that we've heard, the waltz that we heard earlier of your from your quartet, mm-hmm. plus that, are they available commercially? Because people are going to ring me and say, I love that, can I have a CD of it? So,
well, commercial in a sense. They're on my website, and I ask that anyone who downloads the music or the sheet music, the recorded music or the sheet music, makes a small donation to UNICEF. I don't think music should be free. It would undervalue composers and performers. But Google knows where Joe Wolff Music is, and yeah. so anyone who would like to get the MP3s or...
I think that's nice. And you can make a little donation to, or a big donation for that matter, to UNICEF. And Joe Wolff's name is W-O-L-F-E. So tell me, if you're composing and you're in the lab... How are you dividing your time? Because composers need time to expand and think, don't they?
Yes. For me, composition is usually a block. Sometime in summer when I don't have classes, I'll take a set of weekends or even take time off and do it. It takes me a while to swing into the mood of a composer. You've got to have a whole piece in your head, and you want to integrate, particularly when you're orchestrating a large orchestral work. You can't have too many distractions.
You must have a very intimate knowledge of how instruments are played. I mean, what did you start off playing yourself?
Well, actually, there was an accordion in the house when I was a kid, so I picked that up. And then when I went to high school, suddenly there was an orchestra and instruments. And I was first trombone, but then I wanted to get into jazz and there was slot for a saxophone. And so it sort of varied.
Mm. But you now play what? Saxophone?
Saxophone's my comfortable instrument, but I really like playing in orchestras and chamber music, so I tend to play oboe or bassoon and
you
a few
must
related
be very
instruments.
Good, Joe.
No, I'm not very good at any one of them, but I do play a lot of them.
So what's on the drawing board composition wise at the moment?
I do have a project that I hope to get done this summer, and I'm working on the third movement of it at the moment in a scrap paper sort of way. But I wouldn't like to talk about that.
You might put the kibosh on it. Tell us about the principal bassoon player with the New York Philharmonic Orchestra.
Ah, okay. Yes, at the moment in the lab we have Arlen Fast, who's the principal contra bassoon of New York Phil, who's come to do his sabbatical in the music acoustics lab at UNSW.
How did the two of you get together? How did you all get to know about each other?
He's working with an American bassoon manufacturer, one of the world's largest makers, to improve the system of register keys on the instrument.
What does that mean?
The keys you need to get up into the very high range of the instrument. And the bassoon, frankly, is not a brilliant acoustical achievement. It does need improvement. And some of the notes don't start easily. Some of them are a bit unstable. So he wanted to move the holes around and change their sizes.
To make a custom-made instrument, in a sense?
Well, the one that he has with him in Australia at the moment is custom-made, but the maker wants to make that their production model, I guess, as soon as it becomes more widely established.
So what are you doing with him?
Well, we want to analyse the old instrument and the new instrument, see what the differences are, make a good enough model of the instrument to be able to predict what's the very best place to put these holes, how big to make them, and get the best deal for the makers and then the players who use it.
Does this suggest, if he's coming from New York, if he has come from New York to spend his sabbatical here, does that suggest that this sort of work is being done here but not in America?
It is true that music acoustics is one area where America doesn't dominate the field by any means. I guess France, Sweden and Australia would have to be counted as the leaders in...
Can I just take you back to voices for a moment and singing voices specifically? Mm-hmm. Can you... is it just a matter of different physique, that different sort of subtle differences in the vocal tract that produce a beautiful singer in one person and a dud singer in somebody with a tin ear in another?
Well, one thing that you can say about anyone's vocal tract is that its geometry is very variable. The mere fact that they can speak and make different phonemes, different speech sounds, means that they can change the geometry enormously. Some characteristics that are not so changeable are important too. The musculature of the Adam's apple, the vocal folds, that's extremely important. Mm. And then, as with anything in music, how you use it is incredibly
how you
important.
Use it is the trick, isn't it? All right, Joe, it's been a tremendously interesting hour. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. And I want you to introduce your last piece of music, which is not by you, but by Shostakovich.
I'm a great Shostakovich fan. And with most music, I think of the pieces that I've played and therefore studied. And Shostakovich 11 will be known to many people who've seen the Eisenstein movie Battleship Potemkin. And the third movement here is the tragic scene, the bodies on the snow, and you'll hear this ominous cello bass accompaniment. But over the top of that, you'll hear one of the great viola soli of the repertoire with the sense of indomitable will going on despite everything.
Third movement from the Symphony No. 11, subtitled The Year 1905 by Shostakovich, the National Symphony Orchestra conducted by Mr. Slav Rostropovich. Final choice of our guest today, Professor Joe Wolfe, who's co-head with Professor John Smith of the Music Acoustics Group at the University of New South Wales. Continuing with a music theme, Sir Richard Armstrong is joining us tomorrow morning. He's an opera conductor from Britain, very well respected and well liked and highly credentialed. No, that's the dreadful word, with a lot of credentials. And he's in Australia to conduct Il Trovatore for Opera Australia. So Richard Armstrong, Sir Richard Armstrong, joins us tomorrow. Damien Beaumont with Just Classics follows the news.